Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Kerry Curtis, chair of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and your host for today. I would like to welcome our radio audience and remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now I'll introduce our distinguished speaker. Since first being thrown overboard by his famous father at the age of 7 with newly invented scuba gear on his back, Jean-Michel has been exploring the world's oceans. He spent much of his life with his family aboard Calypso and Alcyon, and for nearly 20 years he served as the executive vice president of the Cousteau Society. In 1999, he launched Ocean Futures Society, of which he is still the president. Jean-Michel has produced over 80 films, received the Emmy, Peabody Award, the Set d'Or in France, and the Cable Ace Award. In partnership with KQED, Mr. Cousteau's recent productions are Sea Ghosts, about the beluga whales, which I think you can still pick up on KQED at various times, and Call of the Killer Whales, about the orcas, which will debut on Earth Day, April 22nd, on PBS in the evening. Mr. Cousteau's work has had a significant impact on global awareness and attitudes about our oceans. I could go on at length about his work and accomplishments, but in the interest of time, please simply join me in welcoming Jean-Michel Cousteau.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to visit, and I want you to know that at the end, hopefully, you'll have some questions, whether it has to do with the subject we are approaching or a different topic. You feel free to ask whatever question you may have. To set the record straight, I have been in the United States since 1968. That's why I have a Southern California accent. And I've been involved in a lot of the activities of the productions, but we also very much involved in education. And our programs, besides television, called Ambassador of the Environment. They're also called Sustainable Reef, and now we're getting into Sustainable Rainforest, which will be distributed probably starting at the end of this year in the Amazon, because the Amazon is a very important part of every one of us, whether we know it or not, when it comes to climate change or other important issues. But today we are with our relationship with KQED, which is now over 4 years old, and we've produced together 11 hours of television, some of them which have had a critical impact, including on the ex-president of the United States when he decided to protect the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands or create the largest protected piece of ocean anywhere on the planet, 138,000 square miles, which was followed with very little, you know, good news don't sail very well, which was followed by another decision which was made on the 6th of January this year, or 14 days before he left office, when he declared three other places marine national monuments. One is in American Samoa. Another one is islands on the Western Pacific, which are controlled and owned by the United States. And then the one I worked for the last 2 years on, which is the Marianas Trench and the Northern Marianas, which have been protected. Total today is approximately 300,000 square miles. It's twice as big as the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. It's almost as big as the country of Spain. This is absolutely amazing. I would have never believed that we would be able to be involved to that extent in protecting so much area, which is now, of course, under scrutiny where we want to make sure that what needs to be done in those places is being done. Because it's one thing to decide to protect a place, but what about managing it and cleaning it? There's a lot of cleanup to do. And so we're very involved. It's not very spectacular, but we are still completely involved in making sure that these very now officially protected places are indeed protected. And we are joined to do that with the Coast Guards, with the United States Navy, with the Department of Interior, the Department of Commerce. There's a lot of actors involved in this project. In the recent past, we, and I've always wanted to do that because I've always been fascinated by the dominant species in the ocean, which are the killer whales, the orcas. And I will not say killer whales anymore, although they do kill whales. But that's not just to kill it. It's to find food. There's no animal that I know of that kill to kill. They kill to survive, to eat, to feed themselves. And if you look at orcas, you find out that not unlike humans, they occupy the entire planet called Planet Ocean, or 71% of the planet, from the Arctic to the Antarctic. And although they are everywhere, their numbers, unlike ours, are not that big. We're talking about approximately 80,000 at the most. They can kill anything, they can eat everything, and nobody kills them. Well, other than killing each other, we're the same. The difference is orcas don't kill each other. We are finding out that they're a very, very complex society. They have a very strong group or school, if you want, relationship. So much so that from one school or one pod to another, you have different dialects. So they can recognize each other. Because let's not forget that if our primary sense is vision, their primary sense is acoustic. So everything happens through sound. Finding food, finding their way, they can echo sound, or communicating with each other. And we can say that they have languages or dialects, if you prefer. So from one pod to another, there's changes of sounds. And that gives them the opportunity to either join forces with another pod to hunt or to play. They do play because they are so successful, like we are on land, that they have time to play. And they are also, if you look at where those populations are, some of them are resident populations. Others are transient. Others are open ocean. Others are always in groups. Sometimes they are in small groups, like two or three. And they, unlike other marine mammals, they don't cross, they do cross the equator. They go wherever they want, just like we do. Very, very interesting society. Some of them only feed on marine mammals. Others will feed only on fish. And others will feed on everything, just like we do. And they also are very picky, very interesting, because when they are successful, like, for example, they have been in the Monterey Bay when you have young mother whale coming with their new calf, they will wait for a mother whale to make a mistake, which is to take a shortcut and go across the bay instead of going around the bay where they find protection. And that mother whale will make that mistake only once, because ultimately the orcas, a pod like 20, they will exhaust the mother and the calf and ultimately drown the calf and then start to feed on it. And the mother will keep going on north, and she will never take the shortcut again. And the scientists do know that. Now, what do they feed on? They will feed, in this case, because they are so successful, on the skin or the fatty tissue, if you prefer, the blubber. And then they will feed on the tongue. They're just like the French, you know. They're very picky, and then they abandon everything else. And unlike in our case, nothing is wasted. There are other species, birds or sharks or whatever, that will come and feed, and in the end, there's only bones left. Nothing is a waste in nature. Everything is connected. And we can follow that everywhere in every species, on land or in the ocean. Very, very fascinating when we follow them. Then we realized that not only there are a lot of similarities, but there's a lot of impact on the marine environment in general. And because they're at the end of the food chain, they will accumulate within their systems a lot of the toxins that we allow to go into the ocean. And it's not just what we see, and we're very sensitive to the garbage that we dump in the ocean, whether you live along the coastline or you live in Topeka, Kansas, same thing. As we have the reflex, I call it the monkey reflex, of throwing things out, thinking, you know, out of sight, out of mind, that cigarette lighter, that mascara, that bottle top, that bag of any kind, will ultimately find its way into the ocean. So we're all connected to the ocean, we all depend on the ocean, and we're trashing our life support system. We're nuts. We're complete nuts. And that can change. And that can change. And I'm looking at young people there, because these young people are going to have to be the ones who are going to make those changes. We, the adults, need a kick in the butt in order to change our bad habits. And we can do it, and that's the good news. But in the meantime, you have out there in the ocean all these creatures that we, many of us, depend upon for our food. And those toxins we put in that environment, which we don't see, chemicals, heavy metals, we don't see them. They come back in our plates. And they come back in our plates in the same food that these animals are eating. And we are finding out now that in ourselves we find the same thing that the scientists all over the planet are finding. And as you may know, in the state of California, we use a huge amount of fire retardants, the PBDEs, and although some of them have been banned and are banned completely in Europe, are now banned in the state of Washington and the state of Maine, and questions are being raised. Yes, indeed, we have a lot of fires in California, and we need to control those fires or give ourselves a little time to get away from it. Today, the fire retardant gives you another 12 seconds before it catches on fire. And that's good. And I hope we can find other products that can do the same thing, but that will or do not have other consequences. Because those fire retardants, which we have banned already, and some of them we still allow, are releasing in the atmosphere. You're breathing it right now. I'm breathing it. And it's in furniture. It's in computers. It's in television monitors. It's in children pajamas. It's in your mattress, in your pillow. It's everywhere. And I can't blame the objective in the first place, but we are finding out that all these toxins which are being released, just like the DDT were released and banned ultimately, like the PCBs were released and banned ultimately, we now have the PBDEs. We need to sit down with decision makers, and we've started doing this, whether they are in governments or industries. And I was recently in Sacramento and in Washington, D.C., and we're working with all those people because they like us. They have a family. They have children. They care. But we need to put ourselves in a prevention mode, Unfortunately, we have a tendency to try to resolve an issue and not see what the potential other consequences that these artificial chemicals have. These chemicals are not found in nature by themselves. We create them, we invent them, and they have other consequences which we did not predict in the first place. So we need to put ourselves in a prevention mode. So our expedition all over the planet, we were in Papua New Guinea, in New Zealand, in California, up in Washington State, in British Columbia, in Norway. We spoke and dealt with very, very fascinating people, scientists who have a lot to share with us, because all that information that I'm sharing with you, I get it from them. And we put that on our show. And what we would like to do today is to give you some excerpts of what is going to appear on PBS all over the country, thanks to our partnership with KQED, on Earth Day. What a privilege to have this opportunity to share with the United States population and ultimately the rest of the world those issues. Because it's fascinating, they are marvelous creatures, and I'd like to remind everybody that there's never been an orca attack on humans in the wild, ever. And that's why we don't hesitate to go and swim with them, dive with them. They look at them like we look at that, like they look at us. Curiosity, fascination, and we have a lot of respect because it's their world. We are temporary visitors there. So there are things you don't want to do, you shouldn't do. And that is true for almost any creatures, unless we provoke them or at the wrong place at the wrong time or give the bad message. But they are absolutely fascinating. And what I'd like to do is to give you two interesting moments after a short presentation of the program, which we're going to have right now, please.
Highly intelligent, dangerously powerful, the unchallenged sovereign of Earth's oceans. They are the orca, killer whales, and their complex societies extend back into antiquity. But does our modern society now threaten theirs? Join Jean-Michel Cousteau and his team as they investigate humankind's mirror in the water and discover that the orca's fight for survival is in fact now our own. It's Jean-Michel Cousteau, Ocean Adventures.
So, as a first small story, we were extremely privileged to be in New Zealand with a lady who has dedicated her life, a scientist, to studying orcas. And she's been doing that for the last 14 years, nonstop, 24/7. So much so, we became pretty good friends that one day I said, Ingrid Vresser, Ingrid, don't you have a personal life? And she said, Jean-Michel, no, I don't have a personal life. If I had to have a personal life, I would marry an orca. That's how dedicated she is. She's an amazing, amazing person who is constantly debating between the scientific side of things and the fact that as a human being, you have emotions, and she doesn't want those emotions to get in the way of her research. So we're trying to translate that in a as fair way as possible when we spend these several weeks with her. And as we were watching and recording what she was doing as a scientist, which I have to say, you know, from a spectator, from a visitor, is sometimes pretty boring. But we tried to get the best of it. And one day we were out there at sea, and she had a phone call because she's on call all the time. If there's anything happening with orcas in New Zealand, people tell her. And that call happened when we were there. And that was when a young female beached itself, probably chasing some food. The mother was probably right behind it, trying to catch it, because there are marks on the fluke of it, on the tail. And it was too late, and the tide was moving away, big tides, and that poor whale was just left on the beach. So a call was made by the environmental department saying, Ingrid, let's go there. So they went there. It was in the southwest side of the Northern Island in New Zealand. No access unless you have a 4x4 and way out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the sand dunes. I mean, it was horrible. And Ingrid said, okay, we're going to go by helicopter. So we jump on the helicopter, but there's only four seats, the pilot and three of us, the cameraman, Ingrid, and myself. And the rest of the team is left behind. So they have to drive for 5 hours to approach the sand dunes and ultimately wait for us to come back and report something. And I'd like to share a little bit of that with you. Could we have the next DVD, please? It's too bad you can't turn off the lights because...
New Zealand's rugged coastline yields to a powerful ocean. Here, Fabien Cousteau and the team will encounter an orca culture as different from the Pacific Northwest as the landscape. No one knows them better than Dr. Ingrid Visser. In 1992, she began the first in-depth study of orcas in the South Pacific, and she studies them with a passion. Carrie and Fabien experience what inspires Ingrid.
That was nice, huh?
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Did you get that, Carrie?
Yeah, I think so.
That was amazing. Huh? See, I told you, those two boys, huh?
And they both did that.
Yeah,
they both
did. Oh, no!
Oh, man. That was phenomenal.
Orca Hotline, Ingrid speaking.
In the middle of her research, Ingrid gets a call that a small female orca is stranded on an isolated beach in heavy surf. She and the team rush to assist.
She's somewhere on this bit of coastline here. We're not sure exactly where, but this area here, these lines on the chart are marking that it's really rough and surf breaking. So we're kind of hoping we'll be able to pick her up and move her by tractor and trailer somewhere into here. Okay, well, let's do it.
Go.
Time is critical in a stranding rescue. So Ingrid and Jean-Michel will fly directly while the team drives the 5 hours to the site. New Zealand's hills are bordered by a twisting 9,300-mile coastline. Whale strandings are fairly common, but successful rescues are not.
The orca was first sighted around 1 o'clock by some hikers in a very remote part of the west coast, west of Auckland, tossing and turning in the surf.
We ultimately got to the beach, and indeed, this young female, a little over 3 meters long, was very badly stranded.
So when we actually first saw her, of course, there's just the natural emotions of just wanting to break down and cry and knowing that she's away from her family and knowing that she has no idea if we're people that are going to help her or hurt her.
But help comes by digging holes for her flukes and flippers to relieve the discomfort, then keeping her skin moist. She was probably not alone, struggling in the surf, and another whale may have tried to pull her back to sea, judging from the marks raked across her tailstock. Ingrid names her Reiki. Most important to her survival is keeping the young whale hydrated after hours of stress on the beach. Ingrid is successful in getting her to accept a tube bringing water.
Yeah.
It's a triage that also involves reassurance and comfort. Even with expert care under changing conditions, it's believed that an orca can survive only about 24 hours out of water.
Hopefully, she'll be okay. And hopefully reunited with her pod. She's a young female, needs her family. We're very, very anxious to see her back in the ocean, in her world.
We move the animal just right up above this tiny little town where there is a facility where we could pull the truck and the trailer right next to a freshwater source. So we had a hose where we could water her down, and we had an ongoing watch throughout the night. But finally, by 4 a.m., we knew it was time for Ingrid and Carl and the team to discuss what the options were to get her back into the water.
We as her family, Carl and I have done orca strandings before, where 2 hours after we released the orca, it met up with its family. So it can be a long way away, and the animals will return if they hear her, but they won't be able to hear her calling if she's inside here over the bar with the surf. But then if we take her to the other coast, it's 100% guaranteed she won't find her family immediately.
Yeah.
That's the worst con for both scenarios, is that where is her family?
I defer to you more often than not, biological, in terms of your knowledge of the animals. In terms of running operation, staying here and releasing here is, as you can appreciate, by far
it's
the
much,
most appropriate
it's,
thing
yeah,
to do.
Yeah, it is definitely, but for her, it's better to have her on the other coast.
She knows very well that pods here off the North Island will visit the West and East Coast frequently. So she felt confident putting this animal in the east side of the country that there is a very good chance that this young whale will hook up with her family in the near future.
A decision is made to move Reiki to the east coast, and the team prepares for what must be done to save the whale.
For the heart monitor, we put it on early in the morning, and Ingrid wanted to keep track of her heartbeat throughout the rest of her time on the flatbed.
It's becoming clear to the team that a positive outcome for the rescue is not guaranteed.
For me personally, it was the first time I've seen an orca so close. But Ingrid, with her trust in us, we really were not only filming and assisting, but we were participants. And when she had asked me to sit next to the whale and help keep the heart monitor on her the entire time, it was my job then to really have that continuous touch with the animal and really hopefully transmit my calmness to this animal. And her heart was very normal, was average, between 60 and 80 heartbeats per minute. And there were times when it even dipped a little bit, which was hopefully a sign of her calmness.
And so an unusual procession moves through New Zealand's largest city.
So we drove right through the heart of Auckland, 90 minutes through town, with the moment of just sitting there thinking, I'm with a whale. I'm sitting here with a whale. We finally arrive over the east side and pull into the harbor and the ramp. We're about to put the animal in the water, and there's well over 100 plus people cheering as we drive up.
The whale is gently rocked into the water, but is disoriented from the ordeal and lies still.
From there, there's a full flood of emotions. At first, the animal is hardly moving at all. And Ingrid's like, it's all right. You know, her muscles, if you could just imagine your muscles just cramped for hours and hours and not being able to stretch. So she just is probably just, you know, stretching out and getting back into this fluid environment. And finally, Ingrid says, just have some of the people back away and only two of you stay close to her to support her. Sure enough, as soon as three people backed away from the animal, Carl and one of his staff were right by the head. She just gives a big kick of her tail, and you just see the movement in her dorsal fin just slice through the water as she slowly travels out in the deeper water.
We've heard the stories of dolphins pushing people in need back to shore. And now this team has carried a young whale back to the sea with a chance at life. Perhaps orcas and people share an additional trait, the ability to care for another species, including each other. In our complicated relationship with nature, it may be a bond unlike any other.
So I hope this gives you a very, very successful story, very emotional for us, of course, and it is time where we never forget, and we keep asking all the time, how is Reiki? Where is Reiki? Is Reiki with her family? Is Reiki this, Reiki that? I mean, we're getting tired, but it's so exciting to be able to have this connection. And that connection is very, very critical because it comes back to us in more than one way, as I mentioned earlier. And we would like to today show you what some of those connections are and how does it impact us and why we need to care and we need to change. And the good news is that we can. So for the sake of having an opportunity to answer some of your questions, I'd like you to see the next piece, please. Could we have the DVD, please?
Now, or more than 30 years, we've known every individual that comes and goes, born and die in the population. But one of the downsides is the fishbowl gets contaminated with everything that we're pouring into it, and then it's like a toxic soup.
The transient killer whales are among the most PCB-contaminated marine mammals on the planet, exceeding the endangered St. Lawrence estuary belugas by a factor of 3 to 4 times.
And getting more contaminated.
Yeah. Well, it's very, very difficult to carry out cause and effect studies on the effects of pollutants on killer whales. They're not lab rats. They're not very small. There are ethical and legal constraints to actually sampling them. So often what I espouse is constructing a weight of evidence from multiple lines of research. Harbor seals, killer whales, humans all have the same types of hormones, the same immune system, basically the same organs, they're all mammals. We can use information that we've collected from these various studies. Transient killer whales are in fact eating our study subjects, the harbor seal. They eat marine mammals. Resident killer whales that eat fish come into an area where harbor seals eat fish. So the harbor seal provides me with tremendous power of observation. It's the most widely distributed seal in the Northern Hemisphere. They're relatively easy to handle and obtain samples from, and we understand a lot about them.
Peter, how are these chemicals getting into the marine environment?
Over time, these chemicals either get into our sewage effluent and into the ocean, or they get into the atmosphere and then can move great distances. In the case of PCBs, what we're looking at is a legacy of all of our past mistakes. They were banned internationally several decades ago. And unfortunately, we still have some chemicals that look and act very much like the PCBs, flame retardants, PBDEs, the polybrominated diphenyl ethers, that are doubling every 3.5 years in the harbor seals in these parts. They are persistent, they are bioaccumulative, and they are toxic. In these species, we see population-level consequences. We see reduced reproduction. We see increased mortality. We see increased incidence of diseases. And in putting together the collective results of these multiple lines of research,
all right, so home the mummy.
We can start to understand what chemicals such as PCBs or PBDEs might be doing to animals at the top of the food chain, like the killer whale. And of course, we share the environment with marine mammals. If a marine mammal is heavily contaminated with industrial chemicals, that's starting to tell me something is amiss with our environment. It means our activities are impacting on the health of the ocean, and it's not good for the marine mammal in question. It's not good for the environment. It's not good for the humans that rely on those same food webs.
How far do these toxins now reach, and how do humans compare when tested? Dr. Mary Louise Scully is part of a pilot program with the state of California that is trying to answer similar questions. Three members of the team are tested to see the results from people with different lifestyles and diets, since many toxins accumulate in food. Jean-Michel grew up in France, spent 40 years in California, has traveled the world his entire life, and eats everything. Team photographer Carrie Vondahar was raised in the Midwestern United States, has traveled from the Amazon to the Arctic, and eats everything except fish. Holly Loheis, Cousteau marine biologist, has dived the world's oceans to better understand the subjects of her passion. Native to California's agricultural region, Holly has been a vegetarian for 13 years. To round out the sampling, Holly brought her 4-year-old son, Gavin, to be tested. And like Holly, he's a vegetarian. As the tests are analyzed over 3 months, the team further explores specific aspects of the shared environment between orcas and humans. Jean-Michel and the team spend a day with Alexandra in Johnston Strait, where they are introduced to orca family life.
See, you're a bunch over there. Here they are.
How old do you think that calf is?
Within a year.
I think it's nursing what's going on, and Mom's just sitting there. Hi.
Is that incredible?
Oh, yeah!
Whoa, wow!
Is that a show or what?
Today we have the results. I understand it was because of your concerns about the high level of contaminants in the orcas that led to your being curious about what these results in humans might be, especially since we consume the same fish. And also we're at the top of the food chain, just the same way the orcas are at the top of the food chain in the marine environment. You each have released permission that I could see the results first so that I could go ahead and make these charts. Each graph is going to have the amount, and then each of our names are along here. Jean-Michel, Carrie, Holly, and Holly's son Gavin, and myself, we all agreed to be tested. 50% of the population are below that level, and this line, 95% are below that level. And these numbers were done by the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, where they actually monitored several thousand people. Low is better. You want to be low. So first, the PCBs. Polychlorinated biphenyls. These are manufactured chemicals that actually have been banned now since the 1970s. But because they have a long half-life, they're actually still in our environment, and we're still getting exposed to them even today. Where you find this chemical is actually in fatty fish, fatty meats, and actually even dairy fats. I'm high on PCB.
Cousteau. Yeah.
You are indeed above the 50th percentile. We sort of look very similar, don't we? Carrie, looking very good. Holly, you never did salmon or?
I've never eaten fish, but definitely a meat-based diet growing up, but not in the last 10 years, so I'm not sure how long PCBs actually stay within my fat.
Well, the half-life, they say, is 10 to 15 years. Hmm. So now, Gavin, tell us about Gavin's diet.
Oh, wow, that's alarming.
Does he eat fish and meat? And
no, we're on the same diet.
Same diet. The other thing I was thinking, too, was dairy fats, too. Whole milk or?
No. Soy milk.
Soy milk, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
They have shown that they can transfer from breast milk. Now, we don't want to send the wrong message. There's even some studies that show that the special fatty acids that you get from breastfeeding, which aren't present in infant formula, might actually protect you from whatever toxin you might be exposed to. So, again, a lot of benefits to breastfeeding, but perhaps this might be slightly what we're seeing here in terms of GABAN testing a little higher. So our next one is the PBDEs, polybrominated diethyl ethers. The so-called flame retardants, okay? Now, these are also manufactured chemicals that were added to products to make them flame-resistant. Electronic equipment, you'll find it in home furnishings, couches. They've shown that there are high levels in dust. And this is a study that looked at some of the concentrations, Germany, UK, Canada. And then they looked at some Massachusetts, Washington. But look at us, California.
California.
We are way up there. Products have to pass a flammability standard, but obviously we're now realizing that perhaps there's a downside. What we do know is that children have a lot higher level of these flame retardants than moms. This is one study, fire retardants in toddlers and their mothers. And that's because where do kids spend their time? They spend it on the floor. And in the orcas, they are seeing that this level is going up, not down.
How does it get into the orcas?
It gets into the orcas from the environment and just passes
washed
up the,
down the streams and into the food chain.
Yep. Let's go on to the results. There I am, Jean-Michel. Uh-huh. You didn't come in too badly on this one. Carrie, we'll do you next. Okay, you look pretty good on that one. Holly, according to this, you're definitely higher than the 95th percentile. And we might as well just forge ahead and see GABAN as well while we're here. So, according to Dr. Petraeus up at Berkeley, she really thinks this relates to something in the home environment. She sees these kind of levels, and now remember, Holly, these are just numbers.
I know.
He's testing the way we expected him to. We know that children are high.
That's shocking. That is really shocking.
Which is better? Is it better to keep them in the products? Because are we preventing lots of fires?
Is there an understanding with the increase of the use of these products and the increase of chronic disease within kids that we're experiencing today and learning about today?
Well, again, that's the whole point of this study, is because we just don't have numbers yet. But I think it's frustrating for people because we can't correlate for you exactly what does that number mean in terms of your individual risk, which is, of course, what you want to know.
We worry about humans and human health, but we look at these killer whales, and, 300, 400 times more contaminated. That's on a gram basis. You could compare 1 gram of fat in my body with that of a transient killer whale, 400 times higher, 250 parts per million.
Whereas we know in humans, 3 parts per million is enough to give a mother a deformed baby. Many of the adults that I saw in 1976 when we began are still alive, and a lot of their babies aren't. We should take that message home to everybody that we can't afford to kill off the whales through the toxins, that we're next.
Time is of the essence.
Even if we
see, we didn't know before, but now we do. And it's not an issue of pointing fingers or accusing anybody. But now that we know the consequences, we need to change. We need to immediately change. And if this state is really true to their objectives, then we need to support them as much as we can. Forget about politics. We're talking about life here.
We are completely responsible. Toxins are passed on to our children, and it's the same thing in the ocean. As we now know, orcas are to the ocean what we are to the land, and we are affecting the environment. And what we need to keep in mind is that some of the fish that live in that environment are coming back in our plates.
I think in coming to the surface and occasionally coming into view of the general public, killer whales provide a face for the ocean. And to me, they're telling that story about the impact that our activities are having on a global scale for the public, for regulators, for decision makers.
And the interesting thing about it all, of course, is that if we manage to give the whales what they need, we end up giving ourselves what we need too.
And for me, as a mother with a four-year-old that has high levels of these flame retardants, I want answers. We deserve answers. We are using our children as an experiment, and it's not fair. And I don't want to see those adverse health effects for my own son. And no one else should see that too.
I think people need to realize we're not just talking about save the whales, we're talking about save us. And to do that, we need everything around us.
So this gives you a broad picture of some of the issues that we have to address. And I'm happy to say that attention is being focused on all of that at the moment, whether it is in the state or at the level of the nation. And we are in a position where, as I did recently, sit down with those decision makers, both in industries and governments, local and federal. So hopefully we're going to see some changes taking place, and look forward to reports in the future. But we all care, and we care about, in the end, about our species. It's not just the orcas, it's not just the fish, it's us. So everything's connected. And again, as we've said at Ocean Future Society, which I invite you to join because we're a not-for-profit organization, and because of children, we've made our membership free because, as you know, they juggle with computers and much better than probably any one of us. And I didn't want them to have to turn to their parents and say, Mom, Dad, I need $25 to become a member. So membership is free, and by going on our members on our site, you can get the latest information, which we will keep bringing as this whole issue progress. I'd like to open it for a few minutes to a Q&A, and is that okay?
Yes. Join me in thanking Jean-Michel Cousteau for his remarks.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker is Jean-Michel Cousteau, president of the Ocean Futures Society. And now we have 10 or 15 minutes for some audience Q&A. So be thinking of your questions and raise your hand and I'll pass the mic. I have a question for you, first question.
Yeah?
As the population of the world grows, the demand for dietary protein is growing dramatically. And a lot of that demand is coming from fish. And so I've heard a lot about fish farming in a negative context, but what is your perspective on aquaculture, fish farming as a solution to protein needs?
It's, number one, a very complex issue, and I appreciate your question. I'll try to be as brief as possible. There are two major aspects to this. When on land our population increased, we found out that there was nothing to hunt or gather anymore. So we settled down and we became farmers. What are we farming? We're farming grains and we're farming herbivores. And there's a reason for that. It's fundamentally economical. We're not farming carnivores. We're not growing lions and jaguars to feed ourselves. Unfortunately, in the fish farm industry, we are looking at not all, fortunately, but in many instances, farming carnivores. salmons are carnivores. To make a long story short, to get 1 pound of salmon, you need 2.2 pounds of wild fish caught in the ocean. Does that make any economical sense? No. To make those 2.2 pounds of wild fish in the open ocean, if you go to the bottom of the food chain, you need several pounds to reach those 2.2 pounds. Because little guys eat bigger, or bigger guys eat little guys, and it just goes on and on and on the food chain. So right there, it's a big mistake to empty the ocean to make farm salmon. Completely absurd, economically and otherwise. It's the least sustainable approach to farming that I can think of. In addition to that, those salmon, which you can buy on the market, California being the biggest consumer from British Columbia, we put vitamins, antibiotics, colorant. Colorants are not toxic, but they are still artificial. And now, because there's a new disease, which is called the sea lice, they're putting another chemical which has not been tested on other creatures. And sea lice are part of the family of crustaceans, which are shrimps, crabs, lobsters. And what are those chemicals doing to the other crustaceans if it is going to kill the sea lice? All of that is done in the open ocean. And I've always said that if we're going to farm anything, and I don't mean necessarily plants, but like, you know, the plants being farmed in Japan, for example. But if you're going to farm any animal, if I'm an investor, if I'm going to put money in there, I want to control my investment. I don't want to be at the mercy of a hurricane, of a oil spill, of runoffs of some kind, and all my investment is destroyed. I'm going to do it on land. I'm going to do it on land, and I'm, as long as I do that, I'm going to do it where the demand is. Let's go back to Topeka, Kansas. Topeka, Kansas, you know, they buy their fish, and it comes frozen. Sometimes it's 3, 4, 5, 6 months old. And you have to pay for transportation, which means more CO2. There are people today who are, because when you're in a crisis, and we are in a crisis, where people are becoming extremely productive, extremely inventive, we're going to see some amazing things happening in the next few years. And major breakthrough, whether it's in production of energy, whether it is in the way we farm, and on and on. And there are people today in this country who are working on business plan for Topeka, Kansas, or other any towns. Yesterday I was in Iowa, the little towns there too, where they're going to have a fish farm right there at the doorstep of that city. And they save on transportation. They control completely the product. In other words, nothing will go in the environment and eventually pollute it. And you are providing your customers fresh fish, unlike what happens in most places. So there are new ideas, and it's coming along, and I'm very, very excited about that. So I think the lesson today is that those fish farms have created all kinds of problems, environmental problems, because they are affecting the environment outside the cages or the nets. And recently, there was a major problem with some of those toxic chemicals that were put into the fish farms down in Chile, and I was there a month and a half ago. And you have the salmon fish farms have been shut down because there's a disease that has now invaded the salmon down there, with those chemicals, and those chemicals now have escaped and are in the natural environment outside the farms, affecting everything in the marine environment. 15,000 people have been put out of business because of that. And we found out that the majority of these fish were sent to the United States at a rate of 104,000 tons a year. And it was totally illegal because those chemicals are not allowed in the United States. We are complete nuts. I mean, when you look at the whole issue, you say, wait a minute, stop that. And all these people who have moved to work on the fish farm, I don't know what's going to happen to them and their families because there's nothing else to do there other than glaciers that are melting away. One of them I visited at a rate of 600 feet a year. Moving back, 600 feet a year. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So we, in a world of major changes taking place, we need to face up to it, and we will. I'm totally confident, but we need a lot of brain to start working at solutions, and new ideas, and putting ourselves in a prevention mode. You had a question, madam.
I have the microphone.
You have a question.
I'm sorry. When the glaciers all melt, is that going to impact the whales in their migration or what they do in the future?
When the glaciers are melting or the ice, it's impacting only certain species like the beluga whales, for example, because more than likely the food that they normally feed upon is going to either disappear or move away, and we don't know that they can adapt as fast as it's going to be needed to go to those places. Now, other whales are not as dependent on the ice or the cold environment as the beluga whales are, which you only find in the northern hemisphere or in the Arctic or subarctic region. But I think everything's going to be affected one way or another. I was in Sacramento just a few weeks ago, and there was a gentleman who was making a presentation, which was fascinating, where he was showing us what's going to happen to the state of California in the next 20 to 50 years, where you're going to have the rising of the ocean to the point, and we're not talking about a lot, we're talking about maybe 3 to 7 feet. All of the San Francisco Basin, including the airport, will be underwater. Well, we need to get ready. I mean, the people who don't believe in climate change, they should stay home and watch television, but at our shows particularly. But at the same time, we need to come up with answers and solutions and ideas, because it's not only the fact that 500,000 people in the state of California will have to be moved somewhere else. But what about the infrastructure? What about all those roads along the coast that are going to be underwater? We need to prepare for it. We can do it. It's going to provide a lot of jobs, by the way, you know, which we're dying for right now. So we got to live a different world, and we cannot run away from it and be scared by it. We need to be very creative, and I think we will, because that's in our blood.
In addition to all the toxicity and other problems facing these creatures, what about the problems from sonar, the navies? And
yes, another good one.
Thank you very much. Excuse me, one other thing real quick. Did Reiki get back with the family, or do we know?
I'm sorry?
Did Reiki make it back?
Yes. Oh, yes. We're calling all the time. My father was in the Navy. I love the Navy. And I don't mean just the U.S. Navy. I mean all the navies of the world. We've tried to communicate with the Navy many, many, many times. Unfortunately, since September 11, it's very, very difficult. And I understand why. At the same time, we're seeing now many multiple 11 cases of whales that have died because of the presence of navies of the world, not just the U.S. There are 5 countries outside of the U.S., including France, that use the same technology or the same use of mid-range and low frequencies in order to protect themselves, meaning to protect us from enemies. I can't debate that. But at the same time, what we have done, and we've teamed up with other organizations like NRDC or Natural Resource Defense Council, to try to communicate with the Navy, but unfortunately we had to go to court. And that debate is still going on today, although we made some major progress, whereby we have suggested to the navies of the world places where there are no whales, where they can go out and do their testing, which they need to do. But don't do it where you have 11 species of marine mammals like we do in Southern California and do your testing there, because it's going to be devastating. We're talking about potentially millions of marine mammals, dolphins and whales, that are, and also pinnipeds or sea lions and harbor seals and so on that are going to be affected. So we not only have the proof now, but even the Navy has the proof. They did their research, and they know. So with all the prevention that needs to be put in place and the suggestions on where to do it, unless you're in a state of war because somebody is attacking you, they need to do it where they're not going to affect the marine environment. So that's where we are today. So it's a major issue which has not been completely resolved. But we're trying, and we're still trying to. You know, I met an admiral. I was on a trip, and I met an admiral who was retired. And, we had a very nice dinner together, and we talked about that. And he said, I'm going to go to Washington, and I'm going to talk to the people there, and I'm going to tell them about this, and we're going to resolve it, and so on. And they went to Washington, and they shut him up, unfortunately, because of, the sensitivity of the issue, which was born from September 11. Yes?
What are your thoughts about the effect of renewable energies on the ocean?
Well, there are multiple issues that can be addressed here, and some of them have been addressed decades ago by other nations, amongst others, France, because I was there and I witnessed it, where they were using the tides as a source of energy. There again, we're going to live a very exciting time because brains are at work right now, and I'm a little bit in contact with some of those people. What I resent is going back to the same technology again and again and again, like trying to drill off the coast of California. I think it's a big mistake, because we're going to invest millions, if not billions of dollars, to do the same old thing we've done for a long time. When I believe, not that we should shut down what already is in place, we need that energy, there's no question, we need the independence that we don't have. This great country that preaches its independence is completely tied up to other nations that are spitting in the face of the United States, like Venezuela is with his president. Totally unacceptable. But so we need to recover that independence, and we need to invest our resources in all the other opportunities that exist. And, you know, the energy companies today, the oil companies, have made billions of dollars of profit. And today they do a token just for the media, just to look good, investment in renewable sources of energy. And they still want to do the same thing they've always done. We need to help them change. They really have to start focusing and investing in the future, not the present or the past. And I think it ultimately will happen, but we need to act upon it. What are we going to do? When are we going to do? What are we going to find? One, we're going to use the sun, and we're becoming more and more efficient. Two, we're using the wind already. Now, remember, if you look at what happened hundreds of years ago when, for example, in the Midwest, which was a desert, there was nothing, people were starving, there was no the Indians wouldn't even go there. They would go just hunting, and then they would come back where there was water. We didn't know there was all that water underneath. And we started pumping that water, which has made the Midwest a very, very rich part of the world in agriculture, by having these windmills that were pumping water from deep, way deep sometimes. Well, and that's another issue, because we're running out of that water, but that's another point. And you had those windmills. So we haven't invented anything. Now, you look at the aviation industry. We had propellers, and the first propellers were made out of wood. And then we turned to metal. And then what did we do? We went to jets, right? Or turbines, if you want to call it that way. Well, the whole wind industry is now heading into the turbine industry. And when you go into the turbine industry, on land and even more so underwater, you can have these turbines going really slowly. They don't have to go fast, particularly underwater, because the water is not compressible. And that will allow these turbines to not affect the migrations of birds or the migrations of fish. If that's the case, you can put it in not only the currents of the world, but you can put it in rivers, because it won't stop the fish from going up. Much better deal than having a dam that stopped migrations. So that's some of those people are heading that way, and there's already calculations that have been made where by having a big turbine that will only consume 1%, I'm sorry, one thousandth of the Gulf Stream, you can provide 40% of the entire energy of the state of Florida with one turbine. So although this is on paper right now, but we're getting there. And then in Hawaii, a long, long time ago, you had a very interesting engineer who came up with a very fascinating idea, which was to use the difference of temperature between the deep ocean, let's say 500 feet, 300 feet, 500 feet, and the air at the surface. And when you look at the geology of the continents or islands, on the east side, it's kind of a slopey place. On the west side, it drops off real fast. So let's focus on the west side, because you don't want to go 100 miles or 50 miles to get to the deep water, because by the time you take that cold water, you lose the temperature increase too fast to be efficient. Well, today, there's an example, full dimension, which happens to be in French Polynesia at the Bora Bora Island with an intercontinental hotel. And the owner of the intercontinental hotel, whom I've known for a long time, an American, he's married to a Chinese lady. I mean, it's an interesting mix with the Polynesians and so on. He now pumps water from about 350 feet and bring it up. It costs nothing because water is not compressible. So all you're doing is to displace water. And now you need energy from the surface to bring it above water into the hotel. Okay, so he has a little pump there, and that pump is solar powered. So now the cost of fuel in French Polynesia is gigantic because it's way out of nowhere. Now the entire air conditioning system of the hotel is, by taking advantage of the difference of temperature between the deep water and the surface, where you have a lot of humidity, you're in the tropics there. And just like when you drive your car, on the windshield, you have all that, because it's warm inside and cold outside, you have all this humidity that accumulates on your windshield, and that's why you have windshield wipers. Well, same thing happens there. So you circulate that cold water all over the hotel and puts it back in the ocean untouched. Now, temperature of that water has gone up a little bit, but you know, it's just minuscule in terms of amount of water, it will the initial investment will be amortized within 5 to 6 years, and after that, it will save $1 million a year plus. So, you know, all of this is happening now, and we're talking about very, very creative people who are coming up with answers which have economical incentives. We have to look at nature as a business, and we need to live like you manage a business. We have been gifted, and we are absolutely lucky to have been gifted the world we live in, and that's the capital. And if you manage the capital like you manage a business and live off the interests that is produced by it, then you can go on forever. And we know we have problems because the demand is increasing all the time. We have more and more people. So we need to become better and better managers. But as long as you do that, it's okay. If you don't, then you start to gobble up the capital and you're heading toward bankruptcy. Well, didn't we have a few examples in this nation today or in the world? And we bail them out with our tax dollars. I mean, we're nuts. We complete nuts, and we can turn that around, and we will. We will. We got the huge kick in the butt, and we're going to see some amazing things happening in the future. And thanks to the communication revolution that we have in our hands, people can't lie, cheat, and steal anymore. They get caught. $50 billion, what's his name? And how many others like him? You know, that's a thing of the past. Over. Finito. So I hope I didn't leave you with tears in your eyes, but a smile on your face. And we will make it. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker has been Jean-Michel Cousteau, president of the Ocean Futures Society and a filmmaker. And with that, this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, observing its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.